This is Meet the Writers. Now, Nelson Mandela is an icon for our age, but we know him through our television screens, through his writings, and through the media. There are very few people in the world privileged to call him grandfather, but my guest today is one. She's his former private secretary and comes from an Afrikaans family with deep roots within the former apartheid system. But Mr. Mandela chose her to remain in his service after his retirement from serving as the first democratic president of South Africa. She's written about the experience of being by the side of this extraordinary man for nearly 20 years in her best-selling book, Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. Zelda Lekransi, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much for having me, Georgina. What an honor to speak to you.
Well, it's so lovely sitting here by the creek or wherever we are in Dubai. Lots of water anyway and lots of huge buildings.
Yes, isn't this just unbelievable? What a festival. It is really the world being connected in one place through literature, through words. So it's been an extraordinary experience being connected to so many other authors and being able to share your story on this platform.
And what a journey for a white South African from an Afrikaans background.
Trust me, 20 years ago, I never thought that I would be sitting in Dubai at the Emirates Literary Festival sharing my story of this life-changing experience with Nelson Mandela.
So tell me about your growing up.
Growing up in apartheid South Africa, we were ruled by apartheid and we bought into the system because on every level of society, you were brainwashed every day in the school system. The history that we were taught, we, the white people, were the victors. In our churches, even the word of God was used to support apartheid and approve of apartheid. So you buy into that kind of mindset, you get indoctrinated, and you are happy because you're privilege is protected in a way through all of this propaganda. So growing up in South Africa, I became part of the system. I never questioned my surroundings. I was brought up by a black lady who was working in our house as a domestic worker. She, to me, was different than the rest of the African people or black people because Jochebed, which was her name, protected me against my brother's bullying. And for that, I loved her dearly. It's someone that I relied on as a child for safety. She clothed me, she fed me whenever my mother was at work. So I never made the connection or the distinction that all black people should be treated the way I treat or the way I saw Jochebed. Of course, we treated her in a different way. She wasn't allowed to use our cutlery and crockery, and that I never questioned. But Jochebed was acceptable to me because I could hug her. I would never think of doing something like that to any other black people. The black people outside my house, I was told, were people to be afraid of, people who fought for their freedom, but it would be at the expense of white people. So we had a fear growing up for black people. And that's really the mindset with which I grew up and that I bought into.
Were you very aware of Nelson Mandela, particularly when he came out of prison?
No, not at all. I never heard the name. I was not even interested in the politics of our country or what was happening. And the first time I really heard his name was the day of his release on the 11th of February 1990. I was in our family pool and I was swimming at the time, and my father called me out of the pool and he said to me, we are in trouble now. I said, why? He said, the terrorist has just been released. And I asked him, who's that? And he told me, Nelson Mandela. That was the first time I heard his name and I really had no interest. And the only thing that crossed my mind was, well, this fear in my father's voice. And I thought, well, surely it poses a threat. But him being the father, my dad being the father, I didn't know the significance of telling me because he was the father figure that was supposed to protect me.
So you ended up working for Mr. Mandela. Tell us how that happened.
I applied for a job in the bigger department of the president's office, the Ministry Without Portfolio. I applied for the job in that office simply because it was situated in the head office of the presidency, which is called the Union Buildings in South Africa. Now, that building was close to my parents' home, and I needed to find a job for convenience sake closer to my parents' home. Applied for the job also because it was advertised that I could then spend 6 months of the year in Cape Town. When our parliament is in session, people move to Cape Town, all parliamentarians and office bearers and so on. So that was very attractive to me. The political side of it never crossed my mind, you know, that I thought to myself, well, it's part of a huge department of people, there must be about 200-300 people, and I would never politically be put on the spot. I was at the interview on the day, on this specific day, when the President Mandela's private secretary entered. She was a black lady, and she then announced, she really interrupted the interview, and she said she needed an assistant. And me being there at that moment, you know, I thought to myself, well, I'm right for this job because I'm really desperate for a job in this office. We were never introduced and I was never told where she worked. And after the interview, they called me and said, would you be interested in a job in President Mandela's private office? Of course, being so politically naive and in those early years also so conservative, I thought to myself, well, if it says private, I hope I wouldn't have to go to his house at any stage. I was afraid still. So I asked them, is it in the union buildings? They said, yes. I said, would I be able to travel to Cape Town for 6 months of the year? They said, yes. I said, well, I'll take the job. And on the day when I started the job, I walked through this glass bulletproof doors and I only find four other staff members in the private office of the president, to my shock. And yes, then I was working actually for his secretary, for his private secretary, and that's how I started my career in that office.
Tell me about meeting him for the first time.
That was really a life-changing experience, and that's also why I chose it as the title of my book. Those first words I uttered were, "Good morning, Mr. Mandela." I nearly bumped into him. He was exiting the office, and the first thing you noticed when you met Nelson Mandela was that incredible kindness on his face. He had such an infectious smile and this generosity all over his face. As I say, he smiled at me and he extended his hand. He wanted to greet me with his hand. And to a conservative like me, it was unimaginable that you would shake hands with this person that my people perceived to be the enemy. And I was very uncomfortable. But then I realized he was surrounded by bodyguards. And if I ran away, I would probably end up being chased by the bodyguards or being shot or something. And I took his hand. And the first thing I felt, the texture of the inside of his hand. And of course, only later realizing that the calluses I felt in his hand was a result of the years of hard labor he had to endure. He had huge hands because he was a boxer, of course, before. So it's as if his hands swallowed mine. So there were so many emotions going through my head, and you know, I was really in shock. And finding this person smiling at me was completely the opposite attitude of what I had expected at that point. There I was standing, and then suddenly everything was happening in slow motion, and there was a pause. And I realized he probably posed a question to me, which I didn't hear the first time around. And when I asked him that he repeat himself, he asked the question again, and it was actually in Afrikaans. And I realized that's why I didn't understand or heard him. And it's not that his Afrikaans wasn't good. It is that the last thing my brain expected was that he would speak to me in the language of my people, the people who imprisoned him. And standing there, you know, I was just completely overwhelmed. And he asked about my family and about my upbringing and where I came from and what my position was in the office. It was just unbelievable, and probably took about 7 minutes speaking to me. And then I started crying as well because I felt betrayed by my own people, having been told that this man is so aggressive and he's full of hatred and resentment. And I couldn't find any of that in that few minutes I spent with him. So I'm crying now as well. And then he put his other hand on my shoulder and he said, no, relax, you're overreacting. And, you know, when a president tells you you're overreacting, you compose yourself. So I walked away from the meeting that day realizing that, listen, you need to really know what happened in your country and what are the principles that this man and his organization fought for. And it really started off, kicked off the process of a transformation in my life. And as I describe it, a metamorphosis.
It's an incredible story, and there are so many wonderful moments to pick out. I'm not quite sure where to begin. I mean, I know, for instance, the visit of Bill Clinton to South Africa was a big one.
Yes, of course, the President of the United States paying a state visit to South Africa brought South Africa to a standstill, and that's an understatement in a way. But on the night of the state banquet, I, of course, had one of my very embarrassing moments. I was selected to attend the state banquet as the staff member with President Mandela, and we had to fly with a military helicopter from Cape Town to this wine farm outside of Cape Town, about a 20-minute flight. And arriving on this wine farm, we arrive in this big Oryx helicopter. It's not a very eloquent way to arrive at a state banquet, but I was wearing this long dress, which I hated at that stage because even today, I hate dressing up. And getting out of the helicopter, my dress got caught around the rail of the stairs of the helicopter, and I fell flat-faced behind Mr. Mandela, trying to exit the helicopter. He was busy having a conversation and asked me something. When he turned around, he couldn't find me at eye level. And then he saw that I fell, and the bushes around us, it was all shaking, and everyone was trying to contain their laughter, and I was so embarrassed. And the only thing Mr. Mandela said was, "Darling, did you spoil your dress? I mean, never mind whether you broke an arm or a leg, did you spoil your dress?" So later that evening, of course, as I approached him to deliver a message to him as well, I also stumbled over a brick that was supposed to keep a door open. And then after that, he said to me, no, rather sit down, darling, knowing that probably this night is not going to end well.
You did a huge amount of traveling with him, and he called you his granddaughter. And in fact, you came to this part of the world. You were in Saudi Arabia, where a huge honor was conferred on you because, as we've noticed here, women are not often allowed into the halls of power.
Yes, that was before 1999. We paid a visit to Saudi Arabia, and as you know, those years women were not allowed to enter the palace in Riyadh. And Mr. Mandela insisted and said that he doesn't go anywhere without his secretary. At that time, I was one of his private secretaries. I was promoted the year just before that, I think. And he insisted that I needed to go to the palace with him. And it was very uncomfortable, actually, for me as well, arriving at the palace. And Mr. Mandela held onto my hand, which is not a custom easily accepted in Saudi Arabia, that a married man holds onto a single woman's hand, especially not in public. But he held onto my hand to probably also make me feel safe, and also to prove a point, to show to people that he was willing to respect them, but to a certain extent, because he needed me to be in that meeting and he needed me to support him during that meeting. And then we arrived to see King Fahd, and he was already an elderly gentleman by then. And surprisingly, Mr. Mandela then introduced me to King Fahd as his granddaughter. And I saw the king really being puzzled, but because here is this black man and this white lady, and the black man is calling the white lady his granddaughter. So I saw there was really, he was puzzled by that. And then the king actually extended his hand to me, and that is something that was a great honor to me, because I think at that stage it was only Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton that had shaken hands with the king before. And then Mr. Mandela also told the king that the previous night before I left South Africa, on my way to the airport actually, I was involved in a smash and grab incident at a robot traffic light in Johannesburg, and a thug stole my handbag after smashing out the window of my car. So I really left South Africa with only my passport, which was locked up in my office, luckily, so I could access that. And Mr. Mandela then thought of sharing this beautiful, or this unfortunate rather, this tale with the king. And a few hours later, after we arrived back at the palace where we were staying, the king's people arrived with a brand new handbag for me. And I thought that was such a beautiful thing to do for the king. I mean, he didn't have to worry about me, but he thought it good. Women cannot travel without a handbag. And he sent his people to buy me a beautiful designer handbag, of course, and it was delivered to my hotel. It was just an incredible experience, and something I don't think people often hear of, someone like the custodian of the two holy mosques also showing that humanity, even to European women.
Now, Mr. Mandela was adamant he would only stand for one term, and he finished his term, and that was him retired. But he asked you to retire with him.
Yes, in 1999 he called me into his office, and by then obviously we had a very warm relationship. of course, me still being the employee, but it also developed into a bit of a grandfather-granddaughter relationship. And he called me into his office, and we both had such a good sense of humor. And he said, "Now, I want you to retire with me." Now, I was 29 years of age then. And I said to him, "I'm too young to retire." But that was probably the biggest honor he bestowed on me, to have the faith in me to continue working with him.
And that work took you really into the heart of his foundation. You were running his charity, you were traveling again with him all over the world. It was a very intense and very hard-working relationship. The man was so driven, and you were working 18, 19 hours a day.
Yes, that's right. I think if it wasn't for my age, it would have been very difficult. But at the age of 29, 30, 31, your early 30s, you have that kind of energy to do that. And I was so dedicated to my job. Also, in a way, feeling responsible to ensure that he obtains the goals that he set out for himself during his retirement. And really, he wanted to do so much more still. And me being there and being so loyal and dedicated to the job, with that energy levels, it was possible. But it was really, as I describe it in my book, the crazy years. It feels just like one chunk of life that I can't really remember the detail of, just because I was so consumed by the job and the travel and this all-hour workday. And looking back, there were so many experiences that I wish I had the time to really appreciate even now.
Mm. I mean, for instance, the setting up of the AIDS organization, which used his prison number in conjunction with Bono. And I love your story of briefing him about all the musicians that would be taking part in the concert.
Yes, and Bono's is a beautiful story as well. The first time we actually met him was at after a fashion show and a concert that Naomi Campbell organized. I think it was Fashion for Relief. After this concert, Mr. Mandela, of course, appeared on stage with Bono, and it was the first time they met. After we returned from the concert, we were actually going straight to the plane to depart somewhere else. On the plane, Mr. Mandela took a few moments just to process what had happened on stage, because, of course, people were going berserk when Bono appeared on stage, and Mr. Mandela didn't quite know at that point who Bono was. So Mr. Mandela leaned over in his seat to me. I was sitting next to him, of course, in this private plane. He leaned over to me and he said, "Now tell me, darling, this Bono chap, who is he?" And I nearly died, because I thought, you know, to us, to my generation and people who grew up with pop music, Bono was everything. I mean, he was the ultimate pop artist. And it gave me so much joy to explain to him, you know, that this is what this person did, how they boycotted South Africa during apartheid with their music, and how desperate I was as a youngster to get hold of their music, not understanding apartheid or why they were so hostile towards South Africa. So, over the years, Mr. Mandela, I think it was quite an awakening for him to learn who Band the Queen, who that is, and artists like Annie Lennox and Brian May and Roger Taylor. And so it was quite a journey we took him on. But these concerts did great work in advocating for HIV/AIDS and raising much needed funds to ensure that people throughout South Africa, and especially the underprivileged people, got access to ARVs.
Now you talk about Queen. Tell us about the Queen.
Yes, Mr. Mandela and Queen Elizabeth, of course, shared a very warm friendship. When they were having tea, it was very casual, as opposed to what we think of all the protocol and formalities. And arriving in Buckingham Palace once for a courtesy visit, Mr. Mandela walked to the Queen now to greet her, of course, on the red carpet. And Mr. Mandela had a very wicked sense of humor, but he could also sense in a room if there was tension or, you know, people were being uncomfortable. So he found a way to try and break that tension and diffuse the tension in the room. So he walked up to Queen Elizabeth, and when he saw her, he extended his hand and he said, "Elizabeth, look at you. You've lost weight." And the Queen burst out laughing. It's probably the only person in the world that commented about her weight and managed to get away with it. And afterwards, Mr. Mandela's wife, Mrs. Graça Machel, she actually said to him, "But no, Papa." She called him Papa. She said, "No, Papa, you can't call Queen Elizabeth. I mean, she's the Queen of England. You can't call her Elizabeth." And Madiba looked at her quite surprised, and he said, "I don't understand why not, because she calls me Nelson." So, that was the nature of their friendship. They were really on first-hand terms, and he considered her an equal, and she enjoyed that.
Now, of course, he was getting increasingly fragile, and it became more and more difficult to see him as his family kind of took over. There was a lot of bad blood between some members of the family. You acting as the gatekeeper became very unpopular with some of them, and it was an awkward situation.
It was a very awkward situation, but what I tell people is that it's like thinking of your own family. You know, in my extended family, there's people that I've never gotten along with, and I never will have a good relationship with some family members. And it's like that in all families. And I needed to remind myself that I was merely an employee, and I needed to keep my distance. But the fact that he relied on me so much was a matter of great discomfort to some of his family members, and also the family members that didn't share a warm relationship even with him. So it was a very, very sticky and difficult and messy situation. But I say to people, even today, I try and compare and think of myself in my own family context, and that there may be people in my family that dislike me, and it's the nature of personalities.
Then he was in hospital. It was clear that he wasn't going to last much longer. Can you remember the last time you saw him?
Yes, that was on the 11th of July 2013. Of course, he passed away on the 5th of December 2013, so it was about 6 months before he passed away. I was departing the next morning on this annual bike ride that I put together, a motorbike ride, where I take a group of celebrities and professional people and just whoever's interested on this rural bike trip across South Africa for Mandela Day, which is usually on the 8th, or it is on the 18th of July. So the weekend before, we then usually go to rural areas to work in communities and try and improve the living conditions of people. And before I was scheduled to leave the day before, which was on the 11th of July then, I decided that I wanted to greet Mr. Mandela, to just tell him I'm going on this trip. And when a person is that gravely ill, you never know, you know, when the time comes. And I was concerned that I may be away and something may happen to him. So I asked Mrs. Mashal, his wife, whether I could visit him, and she agreed, also then adding that I had to bring her son, who was in South Africa at the time. He lives in Mozambique, but he was in South Africa, and she said I should bring him to hospital to come and see Mr. Mandela. Arriving in hospital, Mr. Mandela was already, as I say, gravely ill, with a whole lot of monitors and so on connected to him. So it was, I could see he was very, very sick, and they said that he didn't respond for a few days. He was in and out of sleep all the time. So Mrs. Mashal asked me then to allow her and her son some private moments with Mr. Mandela, which I did. After they completed their discussion or their time next to Mr. Mandela's bed, Mrs. Mashal invited me to do the same, and she said she wanted to speak to her son so I could have my private time with Mr. Mandela. And at first I sat down, and then I touched his hand and I started speaking, and I said, hello Kulu. I called him Kulu grandfather. I said, hello Kulu, it's Aldina here, and I've come to just to say to you I'm leaving on my bike trip tomorrow, and you know I do this for Mandela Day, so in your name we'll do well. And then I realized at that moment, you know what, we always neglect telling people how much we love them, and this is my moment. I need to say that now. And I did, and I went on and how much I appreciated him and that I loved him very much. And suddenly his eyes opened and he smiled. He gave me that infectious smile of his, and I started crying immediately, of course. And I didn't want him to see that I was crying. So, I tried to smile throughout this crying. And it was just the most unbelievable moment. And Mrs. Mashal, of course, then she rushed over. And she said, what's going on? What's going on? And she teased him. And she said, but Madiba, you know, we sit next to you and you don't open your eyes and you don't give us that kind of smile. But now Zaldina is here and you do that. So that was the last time I saw him. And that's my most vivid memory of him. And it's imprinted in my mind. And I'm so grateful for that day. Of course, I didn't realize at that point that it would be the last time that I saw him. In the months to follow, they closed ranks and they didn't really allow anyone else to see him or any of his friends or even me to see him before he passed.
And even at the funeral, that was the case. It was very difficult.
Yes, the funeral was very, very difficult. I mean, there was power play going on. We must remember that Mr. Mandela had three families, the first wife, the second wife and the third wife. and then there's the government and there's the ANC and different charitable organizations. So it was really just a big mess. And they didn't allow, I was not the only one. A few people actually weren't allowed to go to the burial site itself. It was heartbreaking at that stage, but I needed to realize that your relationship with anyone is not cemented the day you stand next to an open grave. That happens years and years before. And my relationship with him was sacred because of the amount of time I spent with him, when actually, you know, people didn't want to because he was becoming old and forgetful and so on. So I'm very grateful for how life worked out for me.
And you don't feel that you sacrificed the better part of your youth to be beside his side?
I dare not use the word sacrifice. If I look at my life and I compare it to the amount of sacrifices Nelson Mandela made for me to be able to even be at this literary festival today. I mean, people died for me to have my freedoms in my country, freedom of association, freedom of speech, freedom of choice. And no, if I look at it, definitely not a sacrifice. I've got so much to be grateful for. And I strongly believe in life that deep gratitude creates fortitude. And that has been the story of my life.
How do you feel looking at South Africa now and wondering about his legacy? Has it strayed from the path that he would want it to take?
I think it may seem so at first glance, but it is only because we live in a much more transparent society because of smartphones and social media and so on. I find that the majority of people in South Africa still believe and are still optimistic about the future. They still believe in the values and the principles that Nelson Mandela stood for, that of equality, of freedom, of democracy, and people are willing to support that. Unfortunately, the radicals on both sides of the divide, if you want to call it so, the radicals are very vocal, and they seem to be drowning out the moderate thinking people who's actually the majority in South Africa. So it may appear so, but it's not reality. We should always remember that social media, just it's a skewed reflection of reality, really. So I still believe we are on the right path.
And finally, Zelda, is there one message that you think Mr. Mandela would really like people to carry with them?
There's a lot of disrespect. We now thrive on instant gratification. People, they get influenced by mob mentality. They lose their free will because of social media and this urge to be popular or smart or to be seen to be something they are actually not. So there's a lot of disrespect. It's become the norm, you know, to humiliate people in public. I think the most important lesson that I take from Nelson Mandela's life is that of respect. Respect for people, irrespective of the differences that we project, whether it's ideology, whether it's belief, whether it's religion, the color of your skin. There's much more that connects us than what divides us. And I think he would want us all to look at what really connects us as human beings. And the one thing I take from my time with him, and the most important lesson, is that it's important for us to always remember to choose humanity over ideology.
Zelda Lekhansi, thank you so much. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.